Hey, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with Exchange Wire. Our special guest in the studio today is Christina Constandaki from Viber, CRO with Viber. Good morning,
good
Christina.
Morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Very delighted to have you here. And joining us with a little eye roll there, Lindsay, did you get an annoying message just as I was about to intro you?
Start the timer. No wonder we always go over if
the
I can't start the timer correctly.
Yeah, all essential timer. Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Excellent.
So let's dive into news stories of the week. What with it being August, I have to confess it was a little difficult to find news stories that were genuine things that have happened this week. So this is what we've ended up with. And in fact, they're topics that we often find ourselves chatting about. So the first news story I wanted to speak with you both about is in relation to Netflix. Actually, I've grouped together a couple of news stories around Netflix in general. So the first is that the Brazilian publisher and broadcaster content owner Globo have set up a $50 million content production studio in Brazil to produce their own content in direct competition with Netflix, and they've come out in the media saying that they will never license their content to another international provider, so Netflix or Amazon Prime, and so they're really framing themselves to be a local alternative to Netflix, who are growing in user numbers in Brazil at the moment. The second sort of Netflix-related story comes from The Information, who were writing this week about Netflix's addiction to hit production pieces and hit content pieces, you know, referring specifically to Stranger Things and the likes. And then actually, you know, because they're angling their business towards that content model, that is perhaps driving some new user behaviour that we're starting to see in the US and also in Western Europe, where people are subscribing explicitly to access that content and then unsubscribing afterwards if there's nothing else that sort of appeals to them. And that sort of comes off the back of Netflix's subscription numbers reported in Q2 reducing in the US for the first time. That's not necessarily the trend in international markets, but certainly the trend in the US. And then the third story I wanted to link with that was Vox writing this week that Disney are going to be bundling their content through together with their other owned and operated assets, ESPN, Hulu, Disney Content, and also Disney Plus, and make that available to US subscribers for $12.99 a month, which is the exact same amount as a Netflix subscription. So
this what is a shocker.
Exactly. This is building a picture. And I wanted to hear your perspectives on what type of picture it's building here, your views on Netflix's subs business and the future of the sort of volume of subscribers and subscriber behaviour, and then also whether this is leading us to inevitable challenges for Netflix and the possibility of an ad-funded model. Christina, what's your view to start with?
I think it was all expected, to be honest. I think it's extremely exciting what is going on, because it means that if you have a business that is able to produce content, even if it's localized content, you stand to make a lot of money. So if I were an investor, honestly, that's where I would put my money. Forget about ad tech and all the rest. This is where it needs to go. And we're seeing this trend everywhere, which means that more and more platforms, as the space becomes more cluttered, are going to become like walled gardens, the equivalent of our friends from Facebook and Google, which means that there will be a higher and higher appetite for content.
Yeah.
So there are several ways to go about it. Either you look at monetization with ads, which I think is bound to happen. It's just a matter of time if you want to be able to offer a lower quality content while keeping the subscribers engaged. Or you can even go down the route of having a pricing model where you can rent or buy movies or series, and then you pay for them as long as you watch them. And then when you finish
them. On demand.
On demand. You move on to something else. But all in all, it was expected, because it's a sector that is growing, and it's probably one of the few sectors that is growing after ad tech has been declining for the past couple of years. And we see that the appetite for both the stock exchange and the investors is decreasing for ad tech, which means that they need somewhere else to put their money in. So it's going to go down eventually. It's a bubble, so it's going to burst. So we're going to go back to the market being consolidated. But for now, for investors, it's a very, very, very exciting space.
Yeah.
If I had money, that's what I would do.
Interesting perspective. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
I mean, I think there's so much to unpick here. I mean, so One, I think that Netflix's opportunity now exists in non-US markets. That is where they really have to look to increase their subscriber base, but also maybe look to go down the ad-funded route. And obviously there was a link that you shared, which is kind of the information sort of saying that is where the future for Netflix probably is down the ad-funded route. It's something they've always eschewed before. And, you know, there's been rumours about it for many, many years now, but actually everyone's sort of in the end gone, well, no, all they're doing is increasing their subscription price. They'll be able to make money that way. Not with the amount of money they spend on original content can they keep relying on subscription prices, particularly when, as you mentioned, Rachel, the trend of people kind of basically like flip-flopping and kind of signing up for a month's free trial or a month's reduced trial to watch Stranger Things and then leaving and going to the next one. In the US, it's probably even more prevalent because there's so many, like 40 or 50 different types of skinny bundles from every single broadcaster going. And top it off, now you've got the Viacom CBS re-merger as well, which is another one, will be another one for them to add to. And who knows what the future of Pluto TV will be within that. Netflix can't continue along this thread anymore. But then I guess neither can the others. Like, will Disney Plus not go down the same route as well? Mm. They're now trying to launch another new subscription model, and they've just hired in the UK Luke Bradley-Jones, who's a former UKI CMO of Sky, to launch Netflix's Disney Plus's DTC model in Europe. So they're straight away going in for the European market. We aren't used to loads of different subscriptions like they are in the US. Yes, we have a couple. We have Amazon Prime, you know, the BritBox launching, those kinds of things. But we're not used to it to the same extent that they are in the US, where they will happily pay $10 here, $15 there for a bunch of different subscriptions. So how that will work in the US, I don't know. In the UK, I don't know. But Disney has so much great content under its belt, old content as well, and the entire kind of Disney realm of films, which includes films I didn't even realize were owned by Disney, that they are a really strong contender. Viacom, CBS in the US probably as well, they have a wealth of great content underneath them. The difference there is it's not so much original content, it's more old kind of back catalogue content. So that's kind of the difference. And Netflix has had really great success with Stranger Things and the new content, but also had great success with the likes of Friends.
Yeah.
Which they're no longer going to have access to these kinds of things if the likes of Disney and Viacom and CBS keep taking them away. On top of it, you know, the likes of Globo, for example, which is creating their own content hub is very, very interesting, because most of what we've seen so far has been, as I sort of talked about, back catalogue hubs. And in France, you've now got, I think it's called Salto,
yes,
has just been agreed, which is France Television, TFR and M6. That's another kind of going to be another content hub to rival Netflix and Amazon Prime.
You're going to have a lot of local players.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's going to be a war for content. A war for original content.
Yeah. Original content and also back catalogued content as well. Yeah.
Exactly. And the big players obviously are going to win in the short term. In the long term, I think the competition is going to be a little bit looser. But ultimately, at some point in the future, we're going to go back to consolidating the market with a couple of big players that have the means either to buy a lot of, to generate a lot of original content or the back catalogues.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think CBS Viacom is a great example of that, because they used to be a merged company. They were broken apart by the same person that's just pulled them back together again.
But that then also leads me to the ad-funded model. Let's just sort of roll with this for a minute, because I'm interested to know what you both think on this. Because in Europe, I would argue, well, certainly in the UK, we're used to consuming a lot more free-to-air content, perhaps, than people are in the US. They've been used to, you know, cable-provided content for a long time. It seems to me that there's real value in perhaps an international ad-supported model for the likes of Netflix. And there's also a real opportunity, I would have thought, for, you know, high-value advertising within that ad-funded model as well. So actually running good quality premium content against that ad-funded model. And then, as you mentioned, Christina, the idea of perhaps of something that's a bit on demand, so just watching a program, you know, for a particular price or what have you. But it strikes me that there is a lot of opportunity in that ad-funded model if they get it right. In fact, weirdly, almost mirroring what we've currently got with, you know, linear TV, if you like, in a fashion. Do you think that that's got legs and would be rolled out elsewhere within Europe or other international markets?
Most probably. So what we're seeing at Rakuten, and we have Rakuten TV that is now launching in Central Eastern Europe in about 22 countries. And what we're seeing in terms of appetite from the marketers when it comes to advertising on Rakuten TV is absolutely incredible. So if I get it right, and it's not very difficult to get it right, I think there is a huge opportunity out there because marketers are looking for video formats. Here you're looking at TV advertising ultimately on a premium channel, so there is no reason why it shouldn't work. And from there, depending on who you're talking to, you can be a lot more creative with your advertising rather than just placing pre-roll, mid-roll, post-roll and all of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it can work. And it's not even, look, let's say that Netflix is going to continue to grow in Western Europe for now and obviously the emerging markets. But having an ad-funded model doesn't stop them from rolling this out worldwide. It's not a matter of only doing it in the US because they are losing subscribers. They can roll it out worldwide because the revenue from advertising can supplement their revenues significantly.
Absolutely. And like you say, you know, investors, this is their new sort of ad tech pot, if you like, new toy.
Exactly.
So, you know, and they're definitely going to be wanting to see results, right? So the pressure is on Netflix to make sure that they've got a diversified business model here. Lindsay, what do you think the likelihood of Netflix going ad funded is?
I think it's very high. Mm. I do. But I don't think it will be all or nothing. I think it'll be a hybrid. So it's a bit like Hulu.
Yep.
So if you want to watch the free version or a reduced version, they might do it tiered. So fully ad funded, kind of half ad funded. So you pay a smaller amount for a couple of ads, or fully subscription model. So you pay the normal price you would pay. In fact, they'd probably raise it even further, knowing them, to have a completely ad-free experience. Yep. I think that would be probably at least initially the logical thing to do. And if you look at, you know, their global market, you know, we talked about in APAC, iFlix, for example, in Malaysia, they've gone down the kind of the hybrid route. So you can still do the sub model, but they realize they can't just rely on that. So they have to go down the ad-funded route as well.
Absolutely, because that brings us on to a topic that we talk about a lot, which is subscriber fatigue. So the fact that people aren't going to subscribe to every single content service going, and also the difference between regions, right? So, you know, people in emerging markets and in Southeast Asia, for example, aren't necessarily going to pay the same high value subscription
because they are still streaming illegally. So let's be honest about all this.
Exactly.
They are not going to pay for subscriptions when they can get it for free.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Netflix cannot do what Amazon did and just assume that every market is the same as the US and go and just kind of apply the same logic and the same kind of cookie cutter approach and then go, oh, it hasn't worked. Oh, what? I don't understand why it didn't work. Why do we not understand these markets for? And that's hopefully Netflix realise that.
Totally. So the likelihood of Netflix going ad-funded, should we give it a rating in steins? This is a prelude to Mexico. Kieran likes to write an annual piece on predictions of what's going to happen and rate it in steins. What do you think, Lindsay?
Well, I think the thing is, unfortunately, it's not even a prelude because by the time this goes out, that will all have been published.
Oh.
So, yeah, damn it. And we all know what his, we know what his stein rating is, but
we do.
Everybody else will tomorrow as well.
Ah, there we go.
5 out of 5.
You heard it here first. Not really, second, by the time you'll have read it. Okay, let's move on to the second news story of the week. This news story is focusing on Facebook and privacy. So news released this week that Facebook has paused its messenger monitoring practice of having contractors or human beings listening into users' messages to verify the accuracy of their voice-activated transcription tool. So they did this without telling users. They then got found out, and so they stopped it. They claimed, it's true. They stated that Google and Apple were running a similar practice and also stopped doing that. But they didn't necessarily come out and disclose what had happened or talk about it terribly openly until the news fell that this is what they were doing and they'd stopped doing it already. So this to me looks like another example of the way that Facebook treats user data and Facebook's approach to privacy. It's all building a picture that is increasingly pointing to Facebook being far more concerned about what they're achieving through the use and sort of access they've got to users' data rather than whether they should be protecting users' privacy.
I think it's also a great example of where Facebook continually get in the neck over and above Google and Apple for having done the same thing.
Yeah, that's
like
interesting.
Everyone
actually
always goes to Facebook because they are the kind of privacy demons.
Yep, That's interesting. It's a good point. So that was going to be my question, right? Is, you know, what does this say about the way that Facebook has approached the situation? Also, what does it say? Because the thing that I found interesting, further to your point, Lindsay, that Google and Apple have been doing it too, what does this say about the use and application of voice technology and the privacy issues relating to that? You know, to what extent, I mean, this is not exclusively a voice technology issue, but to what extent will we be able to apply the same privacy rules around voice activated tools and voice activated technology that we do around, you know, in written, in print pieces of technology. Christina, what's your view on this particular news story?
Yeah, I'm not even sure if I should be surprised, shocked or amused by the fact that we are still discussing this. I mean, we know what Facebook is doing. I don't see what the question is there. We've known it for some time. The fact that this has made it into the news is probably only relevant to us in the industry. I don't think it's relevant to the users in the sense that they actually don't care. So I think I'm a little bit cynical about it. Everybody knows what Facebook is doing. The difference between, I think, Facebook and Google and the others is that Facebook now are trying to reposition themselves as holier than God, this is us, how we're going to protect your privacy, when clearly they are doing nothing to do so. So this is where the hypocrisy comes in. It's just a marketing spin. There's no real work behind it, or if there is some, it's very little, and only because they were found out by a nosy reporter. So, you know, Facebook are Facebook. Clearly, they have tools to bypass any local or international laws. I don't think they actually care about user privacy. And it's up to the users to take a stance.
And is that ever going to happen, Lindsay?
No, because I agree with Christina that the users
they just
the
don't,
users
care
don't care
enough.
Or I also take the stance that users aren't aware. Like, so if you look at,
but that's what's interesting about it coming out in the news.
Yeah,
though,
if you look at what the news is that they were doing it to users of Facebook Messenger that had agreed to have their voice messages listened to in the first place. But what the actual T's and C's actually say is that they will be listened to by robots, by machine, the automated machines, not by humans. So what they lied about was the fact that robots could listen to you, but we're not going to say that humans can, and in the end, humans did. But then from our industry, the reason why humans were listening is because they were obviously having to train the algorithms.
Yes, exactly.
So AI can't work without human intervention or human interaction. So we are having to train the automated robots to actually make them understand better what the humans are saying in the first place. The bigger question here is, why do Facebook even care what the messages say in the first place? Why should they even be listening via automated fashion, let alone via humans, to
because
what people are putting on messaging?
Data.
Well, that's exactly the point.
So it all comes down to data.
That's exactly the point. Like, the actual reason for a human listening, and the logic of why a human's listening, it makes sense. But actually, Facebook shouldn't be listening in the first place because it's a private message. But at the same time, they're reading your messages, so then why can't we listen to them? But then it ties into, you know, Amazon Alexa to Google
That's
Home.
That's what I mean. Voice activated
Facebook
technology.
Facebook portal as well. Facebook's still kind of launching their weird portal thing that's going to be a screen. They reckon it's going to be the king of video calls, but I think it's kind of terrifying to have a Facebook owned screen in your property is awful. But, you know, people still think that, you know, Alexa, for example, only listens when you say Alexa. They think it's activated by you saying its name rather than being an always on mechanism. Alexa is always on, always listening. If you go into your app sometimes and if it reacts to something really, really weird and you go and listen to what it's listened to, it's actually quite terrifying because it takes all the sounds from the house around you and it hears some random little thing that might not even have been words. This happened to me at 3 o'clock in the morning where it thought that some random thing said the word Alexa, so it woke up and started playing music. It was the most terrifying thing. And all I could hear was the sounds it was making. It was like just random, you know, like electronic sounds. And it decided that from that it heard the word Alexa and started playing music. Absolutely terrifying. At 3 o'clock in the morning in a different room.
So turn your Alexa off.
Yeah, put it on mute at night if it's going to do things like that. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
But that's what it's always listening, always on.
No, but in their defense, it's not really a defense, but let's say that Google, I mean, all of these are utility apps. They serve a purpose. Ultimately, you do something. Facebook is a social network. What do you care? I mean, why do they care what you are talking about unless they want to feed you some sort of ads that are going to make you, you know, click and it's going to ultimately increase their advertising revenue. That's the main difference. With Alexa, I can buy my groceries, I can do things, I can buy something, but I can use it for a real purpose. Facebook has no real purpose. That's where
they're obviously trying to change their mind with Libra, which is not owned by Facebook. They're only part of it, of course.
Well, indeed.
What the world needs.
I know.
I wish you could see Christina's massive eye roll there. It is epic, of epic proportions.
But that is a very helpful, what's my favourite word, segue into the next story. Into the next story, because this is all kind of linked, really, which is Facebook and anti-competition, right? That therein lies the Libra conversation. But I suppose to just sort of, close the loop a little bit on what we're just talking about, this is the thing that makes this story about Facebook and privacy quite creepy, is the fact that we know that the only reason they're interested in that user data is for advertising purposes, despite what they might or might not say. And the real issue is the degree to which, never mind the degree to which Facebook cares about users' privacies, but the degree to which users care about their own privacy and the data that they share with Facebook. And I just, and when you said, Christina, I suppose the only people that this story will have been interesting to is us because we're in the industry, I really hope it's not, though. I really hope it's interesting to people that think, do you know what? Yeah, okay, listeners, if only you could see.
Lots of like shoulder shrugging and eye rolls.
Lindsay and Christina's eye rolls, you'd know that it's clearly they're giving me the message, time to move on to the next topic.
But to go back to the previous story, which I won't drag on that too much, but those people that accepted to have their voice messages listened to probably didn't even realise they accepted it in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
So
herein lies the whole terms and conditions checkbox that nobody reads. So, yeah.
Like the whole face app thing that people were literally signing their life away. We now have access to your face in perpetuity. Yes, your same face that unlocks your phone. That's now freaking everyone out. They've realised it. But you show it to a 12-year-old, they go, eh. So?
We're doomed. Okay, no, I'm not going to say that. Right, let's move on to the next story. Facebook and anti-competition. While we're on the Facebook rant, let's carry on. Right. The news story that came out this week on Facebook changing the sort of name and the messaging behind the names of WhatsApp and Instagram. So they're going to rename them WhatsApp by Facebook and Instagram by Facebook. So they're kind of, you know, reclaiming the sort of brand around both of those products. We found a really amusing piece written by Scott Galloway on his blog, who always writes very amusing and very pointed.
Brilliant.
Yes. Indeed.
Fantastic.
Indeed. We all enjoy Scott's musings about how this just seemed like the worst idea in the world from a brand association perspective, because Facebook has just encouraged so much negative attention and over the last 18 months, and don't clearly, apropos of our previous conversation, don't seem to be able to divorce themselves from controversy and the image that they don't care about users' privacies. Why on earth would they want to link these two independently very successful products to the Facebook brand? Of course, many people know that they're already owned by Facebook, but there's probably lots of people in other countries that don't. So why are they doing this? His conspiracy theory is in order to tie those assets much more closely to Facebook, such that should there come a time when anti-competition authorities, particularly in the US, are wanting to look at whether these companies need to be broken up for a multiplicity of reasons, Mark Zuckerberg and the Facebook team will be able to argue that they're so inextricably linked that breaking them up would destroy the company, and that would be, you know, the wrong thing to do in the face of any kind of anti-competition laws. So what do you two think about this? Is Scott right in his conspiracy theory approach? And are we seeing basically a move that's coming from someone like Mark Zuckerberg, who has got ultimate control over Facebook assets, almost his kind of final move in a chess game to say there's no way that you're going to be, I'm going to do everything I possibly can to ensure that you can't break my company up the way that you might want to. What do you think, Christina?
I think there is no smoke without fire. So obviously we can speculate on this theory. We will never know how right or wrong we are. But it boils down to two things, which are very, very real, irrespective of any of our speculations, which are data, data, data. I mean, the guy has balls. He wants the data. We know that he wants the data, and he wants the data so that he can sell more ads. So irrespective of what is going to happen with the local governments that might put their nose into Facebook and might want to break the three companies apart, we know that even if that doesn't happen, he wants the data. And he wants to put it out there in front of the users and the consumers and say, hey, in case you didn't know, which probably you don't, these all three companies belong to Facebook. Therefore, all the data is going to be buried in the T's and C's on page 265. And you're not going to know that actually now we have access to everything that you do. So it comes down to data on the one hand. And the other argument, which I think it's equally valid, it's ego. I mean, it is Facebook. He has a big ego and he wants everybody to know that these companies belong to Facebook.
Mm.
And from a market, not from marketing, maybe from a marketing perspective, the move is stupid because obviously you are devaluing two brands that are extremely valuable by themselves.
Mm.
But on the other hand, the value of a Facebook brand is even higher. So he's only going to be strengthening it even more.
Mm.
So, but for his ego must be, you know, the ultimate goal, because it's then Facebook and Google and there's nobody else. And Amazon, but Amazon is slightly different. It's a different story. So, yeah.
Interesting. Lindsay?
I mean, anybody else get the feeling that Christina is really, really not a big fan of Facebook? Is that coming across anybody else?
No.
No?
Was very subtly put.
To say that.
Very subtly put.
I agree with everything you just said, Christina. I think that obviously this is putting a label on top of what they're already trying to do, which is actually combine the tech together, which we've talked about in previous podcasts. They've been trying to do for a while. So they are trying to inextricably link them all together, and then putting the cherry on top, which is naming them all by Facebook, is just, I think, absolutely nonsensical. And, you know, I use Instagram, I use WhatsApp. I'm very, very well aware that they're both owned by Facebook, but I'm not a Facebook user. I deleted my account. And literally adding the name by Facebook on them, even though the fact I know they're owned by Facebook, just annoys me so much.
Making it even more creepy.
Yeah, I just find it really bizarre. But like the thing that Scott Galloway was talking about was Volkswagen, who own Porsche and BMW, are going to say that they're Porsche and BMW by Volkswagen. Now, I'm a BMW owner. I know they're owned by Volkswagen, but actually it annoys me so much that I might not buy a BMW because I don't want it to be BMW by Volkswagen. I just don't. No offence to Volkswagen, but I don't want the association linked.
And,
like, it just wipes billions off brand equity. It's a really dumb idea.
That's the thing, and that's his argument. I mean, you're right, Christina. The value of the Facebook brand, particularly globally, is probably much bigger than that of WhatsApp and Instagram. But Scott Galloway's point is, for some people, it's going to be a devalue instantly.
Yeah,
it's going to be, you're reminding me, or I didn't know, and I don't like what Facebook has been getting up to. And actually, why are you doing this? Oh, now you're getting all of my data, and what are you going to do with that data? Of course, that's us just kind of hoping that's me hoping that some people will realise that that's what's going on and get in the way of it and actually stake a claim in the ground and say, no, you can't access my data. I'm not going to use these assets. And, you know, take their bat and ball and go home and not play in the game anymore. But I don't think that that's going to happen with that many users.
I think it's wishful thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, they already have a tie on the open web anyway. Like, they're already tracking everybody, regardless of whether you have any dealings with any Facebook owned product at all. You're still being tracked by Facebook, and they're saying it's for the safety of the web.
Mm.
So you can't escape them either way. But don't label it everywhere. I mean, we just don't need to know that kind of stuff.
So, you know, and I suppose Scott Galloway's piece was also probably trying to get the attention of anyone in the DOJ and the DOJ and the FTC that might care from an anti-competition point of view, because he really eloquently puts that, you know, Facebook being the parent company, WhatsApp and Instagram are like the stepchildren.
It's a great analogy.
And it's commonly known that parents don't necessarily care, step-parents don't necessarily care about their stepchildren as much as they do their real children, but that actually, you know, just bringing them all together under the same surname doesn't necessarily indicate you care about them as much as you ought to. And
to the
they might
world,
get broken up.
It seems like you care.
That's
but
right.
Internally, but internally, you actually couldn't give a crap.
The others that know, that's not the case. So it'll be really interesting to see. I mean, I still think because we talk about it so much, but we talk about it so much because it is in the media a lot, I still think that there will be something around anti-competition. And, I mean, privacy, we know for sure, privacy legislation is definitely coming down the line in the US. The degree to which it actually has an impact obviously remains to be seen. But there's definitely going to be something that's going to happen around anti-competition in the US, focusing not just on Facebook, but Google, Amazon and Apple in the next 12 to 18 months. I just can't believe that nothing will happen in that department at all.
But you can link the tech together as much as you like. It doesn't mean that if it's demanded, it can't be broken apart again. It will just make it more convoluted and just drag it out more.
But and you've reminded me, Lindsay, they did actually say a while ago that they were going to do this in the back end.
Yeah.
That they were going to link, you know, WhatsApp and Facebook's operating systems in the back end. So
I think we come back. I think that ultimately, if we're putting Facebook alongside Apple, Amazon and Google, we're going back to the fact that these are utility app versus a social network that has no utility. So while they might be conglomerates by themselves, they serve a purpose. They deliver a product at the end of the day. is not the case for Facebook. So why is it that you need all this data and you need to do all of these things if it's not to make advertising money, which, by the way, none of the users are seeing any of it back. So it's not exactly the same thing. You make cars, you know, they are good. Okay, what's the purpose of Facebook? I don't understand.
That's a very good question, Christina, and one that deserves a podcast all on its own. What is the purpose of Facebook? But since time is finite, let's move on to the second part of the podcast. On the topic of utility apps, let's talk a little bit about what you're up to at Viber, Christina, what you're focusing on at the moment, and, perhaps talk a little bit about Viber's business and where it's growing.
I think it will become apparent now where the Facebook hatred comes from.
Not true. I got rid of Facebook way before Viber. So No. So what we can focus on, what we're not doing, which is actually we're not accessing any of the private conversations and we're not recording any of the conversations and we don't store any of the data. So we try to respect people's privacy, whether they want it or not. I think we're doing something wrong, obviously. I'm being sarcastic, but... at Viber, we are an utility app. So the main goal of the app is to serve the purpose of allowing users not only to communicate by messaging, but also phone calls outside Viber. So we provide a range of services that ultimately are going to enable somebody that wants to call somebody else that is not on Viber, that is in a different country, that is not in their network, to do so at the most competitive prices. And as somebody that travels a lot, way too much actually, and calls internationally way too much, I can tell you that for me, it's a real service. And even if I weren't with Viber, given the tariffs that I still have out there for phone calls outside the EU, I would desperately need it. So we are an utility app that provides a range of services for the consumers. With that in mind, we decided that we can try and mirror that based on the interest expressed by the consumers into offering certain marketing tools, or rather marketing channels, to the advertisers and to the marketers out there, where we allow them, unlike Facebook, to start a one-to-one conversation with the users, but only upon the users giving their consent to do so. So it's a dialogue. It's a place where a lot of brands, a lot of utility brands that offer services, find a mix between marketing and customer care, which is why we go way beyond just advertising. Advertising is available. We have some ad placements, not a lot, because again, being in a messaging app, you can't afford to just plaster banners everywhere. So we have 3-4 ad placements today, native, that can be purchased programmatically by advertisers that are looking to enhance their brand awareness and so on and so forth. But ultimately, what drives us when we're looking for partnerships is relevance and utility to the consumers. So if you are a banking institution, if you are a food delivery app, if you are a transportation services app, there is a way to work with Viber where we make sure that the users are using your service in a native way to the messaging environment. So that's what we're doing in a nutshell.
How do brands, if for the native ads that you can buy programmatically, how do brands then plug into your supply?
We are integrated with a couple of ad servers.
Well, right.
We have an ad stack that is available on Google and a couple of other DSPs. We are adding now audience segmentation to it. And it's important to notice that this audience segmentation is not based on private data. Again, we're not going to be using the user's phone numbers. And like I said before, even if you wanted to, we don't store any of the exchanges that are going on, because the technology was built like this from the very beginning with end-to-end decryption in mind. So we don't have access to it, even if you wanted to. So what we're doing is looking at the public activity of the users in the app, namely the type of communities that they are following, because Rakuten Viber has partnerships with the likes of FC Barcelona, with the Warriors, with Shakira, with a couple of other, sports and entertainment entities, the type of sticker packs that they might be downloading, the type of content that they consume. And from there, we infer interest-based segments that we're using in order to put a relevant advertising message in front of the user.
Right. And so just to, so you aren't like allowing people to target by phone number, but are you able to use that as a persistent ID?
No.
To be able,
yes.
You are. Yeah. Right.
I mean, we're just using as a persisting ID to identify that these are real users, but we don't know who they are.
Yeah,
we don't
sure.
know their name. We don't even know their the name that they give themselves on the app, because they might be, you know, they might not give a real name. So we don't use any other private information.
Interesting. And what's your market profile? Because I know Viber, but I'd never really think of it as a messaging app that we use much in the UK.
No, and I think it was really popular when it first came
yeah,
out.
Yeah,
and for phone calls. You know, at the time, I remember it sort of appearing like a really good alternative to Skype at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it grew and changed as a business, and then other things cropped up in the meantime, lots of other distractions from a consumer point of view. So, yeah.
Yeah, so Viber has been around for 8 years now, so it was way before WhatsApp. It was very strong worldwide. It's still very strong worldwide, but now we are more skewed towards CISE and Southeast Asia, where typically the penetration, the minimum penetration, will be around 60-70%.
Wow.
So worldwide, we have a little over 1 billion users that are registered, which is a decent number. And the leading regions, like I said, are going to be CIS, CE, Southeast Asia, Middle East, and then Western Europe in the US. It's a low penetration in the space of 20-25%, which for advertising purposes alone, if we're looking at the programmatic space, still makes it a more than decent source of inventory, because all the traffic is direct. It's a brand name. It's real users. We don't have any of the fraud issues that you hear about, and any of the lack of transparency and all of that. So
much more contained environment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And plus, it's a messaging space, and we're looking at it very differently from our competitors. First of all, our direct competitors are going to be WhatsApp. WhatsApp is not monetizing as of today.
Mm.
Secondly, when we look at the makeup of the audience, we're seeing that our audience is slightly older, meaning that 65% of the audience is going to be between 25 and 45, which means that we're not going after a very young audience. We're not looking to promote advertising that is going to be appealing to kids and teenagers, but people that can actually buy these products, which is why financial services and utility apps are very, very predominant within the app, because there is a real relevance and use for them, rather than just clicking on a banner.
And you are working obviously through agencies, but also directly with some brands as well. Are you finding, where you're working with brands direct, is there a particular sort of profile of brands that are particularly coming to you, smaller businesses, larger businesses, or, you know, perhaps like you say, because you're working across Central Europe and Eastern European markets and also APAC markets, are you talking about there perhaps working with direct brands that are much more local and locally known? What's that? What does that look
it's
like?
It's a mix, really. So we have a couple of global, we have several global brands
yep.
that are known worldwide. We have the likes of Coca-Cola, L'Oreal, Pepsi, McDonald's, all of these guys that are looking for advertising channels. So we work with them directly, and then we execute potentially through the agencies. But when it goes beyond just advertising and we're starting to get into the space of chatbots, of engagement, of starting a one-to-one dialogue, of communities where it's a one-to-many, so it's a complementary approach to chatbots, we tend to work a lot with local players, because they are the ones that are providing relevance to the user experience in these markets. So that's why I was referring to financial services. Funnily enough, we have a lot of financial services, the least sexy vertical out there. Let's be very honest about it. And you can do all your banking operations, from paying your bills to transferring money to actually paying for stuff, on Viber, which means that the banking institutions are left to invest resources elsewhere rather than their own app. And they take care, they provide the customer care through a channel that is recognized as not only secure, but also well-known enough to be considered an official channel for a bank, where we know that the regulation is a lot more strict and the information is a lot more sensitive. Or were they not, let's say, 100% sure that the communication is entirely secure, they would not be using us, because they would not be allowed to.
Yeah.
So we have banks, We have, like I was saying, transportation services. Southeast Asia, for example, typically Grab, who is one of the, well, is the biggest player in the area, are going to be providing a range of services through Viber because they don't only do transportation. And this is something that we've seen for the past couple of years now. At the time, actually, we were even working with Uber before they were acquired. And Uber's approach was much more like, you know, a discussion with Amazon and Netflix. So for them, it was advertising. And we were trying to explain that if you want to make the most of the messaging space, you have to go beyond just putting a banner in front of a user and integrate in the messaging experience and allow users
fully engaging with them.
Exactly, yeah. To fully engaging with them. But that's not something that they were considering at the moment.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, yes. and not surprising, that is very interesting.
That
actually your life working with Grab is a bit different because they clearly view their business completely differently. Yeah. What I just wanted to ask is, well, then when, you know, in those conversations with brands, how easy has it been to get to the value of these other things that they can do with Viber as a utility app? Is it something that you find that they're quite hungry for, you know, and is it also something that they perhaps come to you with an idea already and say, oh, look, you know, actually we're wanting to do this. Can Viber, is it something that the Viber platform can support?
Yeah, it can be both. It really depends on the advertiser and it really depends on the market. There are advertisers that are a lot more versed in marketing practices where they come with ideas and from there we say, okay, we can do this, we can do that, this can be done, this is relevant, this is not relevant. So we push back or we tailor. Ultimately, all the solutions that we have are customized to make sure that we meet their KPIs. We don't have a one-size-fits-all solution because, again, in the messaging space, ultimately each and every user is going to be reacting differently to what you put in front of them. So we can't afford to just say, oh, this is what we do, and if you don't like it...
It's not a one-size-fits-all,
exactly. Exactly. So it's a mix. Look, a brand like Coca-Cola, typically the least transactional brand in the digital space that you can even imagine, they are extremely... creative and agile in their execution when it comes to working with Viber. In the sense that not only they bridge the gap between offline and online, and they have a lot of TV promotions and in-store promotions and, you know, all of the product promotions where they have the codes under the caps and the barcodes on the bottles and all sorts of things like that. So they managed to bring together Viber with all of these other channels and make Viber part of a marketing mix where the users actually can redeem prizes either through Viber. And from there, they take it one step further. And we had a Christmas promotion, a Christmas campaign where the more logo was do a good deed or something like that. And we integrated user-generated content where the consumers had to film themselves doing a good deed and then share it with a number of our Coca-Cola customers, and people would be voting, and they would, you know, it was like a challenge, but customized for the messaging environment, where ultimately you not only have the pure marketing purpose, but also the gamification element that goes to it. Mm. And ultimately, you actually link it back to the transactions and to the in-store purchases, because all of this is tying back to the sales on their end. So that's one example. And then other brands are going to be, especially in the utility space, are going to be like, okay, what can we do? We have this. We need to be able to engage in a dialogue with the user. This is our product. How can we make it relevant for the Viber messaging space? From there, we build something else for them.
It seems like the brands that are coming to you are asking the right questions, and you use the word gamification, which is a word coming up more and more, particularly when it's getting brands to understand how they can actually invest in the mobile space and engage with their consumers in the mobile space. And they see the term gamification and think, I should be doing that within messaging apps, within games, whatever else. But, well, I just sell toothpaste. How do I gamify my brand? Like, I can't do that. And actually, it's those that are coming to people like you and going, help me. How do I do this? That you can go, there's so many options available to you. Just don't think of it as toothpaste. Think of yourself as something beyond that.
Yeah, exactly.
So you find yourselves doing that sort of education piece a little bit in some of your conversations.
Absolutely.
With brands.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Mm. I mean, up to a certain point, because then we are not on the brand side, but of course, looking at what has worked and looking at the user response, we can suggest some things to do. And we need to do it because ultimately, for messaging, it's not like the user are gonna, if you serve them content that they don't want or they find intrusive, or they find abusive, or they do, it's just not relevant for them, they are going to leave. It's as simple as that. It's not like, oh, I'm going to look at a different page. Oh, I'm just going to ignore this. No, it's, if it's there in your private space, in a closed environment, either I like it or if I don't like it, I'm going to sanction you. So we need to be very careful about the type of partners that we bring on board and the content that they distribute on Viber. Because it's on us, it's not on them. Ultimately, for them, it's just an upper marketing channel. So, oh, if it doesn't work, they're going to go somewhere else. But for us, if it doesn't work, the users might be leaving. So
you have a real interest in retaining that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it's a way for consumers not just to interact or engage with a brand on a marketing level, but also, and obviously on a utility level as well in terms of paying bills, but actually if they need to contact the customer support, they can do it that way as well.
Yes.
And you think of how it's just such a common thing now for, rather than somebody calling up customer services or sending a message, they go to Twitter and do it that way around. Mm. I'm thinking of like Lush, who closed down their Twitter account so that people couldn't contact them and with complaints or with questions or queries. One of the dumbest things they could possibly have done. And actually, because it's just such a natural thing for the next generation to do now when they want to get hold of a brand is to message them. So it seems like it's a great way for Viber to be able to engage with them.
And that's exactly what we do, because if you do it intelligently through a chatbot, and chatbot, again, it has been discussed and over-discussed, and frankly, very few brands, at least in Western Europe, get it right. I haven't seen any. So it's not just a little dialogue box that appears on your website and you're trying to get rid of it. But if you do it right, As a consumer, you have the impression that you are being listened to. So you have access to content. You have access to somebody that is going to be answering your queries and you don't have to spend 20 minutes on the phone pressing every button. Whereas as a brand, you also have not only full control over the way you communicate with the consumer, but it's in a controlled environment. So it's not for everybody to see. So if somebody is not happy, rather than posting it for your entire customer base to see how unhappy they are, hey, they just say it to you, and then you can address that in private. So it's a no-brainer, but it's still very early days.
Yeah. It's really interesting, though, Christina. I think we've probably run out of time, looking at Lindsay's counting clock there. And so we're going to have to wrap it up.
Good point.
So we're going to have to wrap up. But yeah, thank you very much, Christina. That was really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. That was the Mad Tech Podcast.